Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO, and I'd like to welcome back to the program today Paul Dixon. He joins us by telephone from somewhere outside of Washington, D.C. Welcome to the program, Paul.
Thanks, Vic. It's Garrett Park, Maryland.
Garrett Park, Maryland. Isn't that near Washington?
Yes, it is.
Okay. You are probably the most prolific, dare I call you a scribe, that I know, Paul. How many books is it?
It's 50, high 50s somewhere.
High 50s.
Yeah. It depends on how you count them. I mean, a couple of them I did with other people. You count those as a half, you know, but high 50s is good enough.
Okay. And you had a book that came out recently called, it's a book you edited called Baseball Is, Defining the National Pastime.
Yep.
And that's a little book. Yeah. And then you have a great big book that's just come out in paperback, and I'm so excited that this is out again because it gives me an excuse to interview you for it again, and that is the Dixon Baseball Dictionary.
If you bought those by the pound, it would be a runaway with them because the dictionary is almost 404 pounds.
Uh-huh.
So.
Well, I love talking baseball with you, Paul, and we're delighted to have you back on the program, and I understand that you're working on a baseball biography that's going to be out next year.
Yeah, I'm just going through editing now. I've delivered the all important first draft to my publisher, and it's called Bill Veeck, Baseball's Greatest Maverick, and it will be about the very wonderful serial owner of baseball clubs.
And he was quite a showman. I can remember as a boy reading about his famous pinch hitter for the St. Louis Browns.
Yeah, that would be Eddie Goodell.
And wasn't he also involved with the notorious demolition at Comiskey Park?
Yeah, disco demolition night. That he staged with his son Mike, who was getting into the business at that point. But and those are sort of the hammocks that everybody's got about Veeck. You know, that's they string it on those two incidents. But in reality, there's so much more to the man. I mean, he has an influence on integration in baseball. He brings in Larry Doby. He integrates the American League just 11 weeks after Jackie Robinson is brought into the National League. He is very early in trying to get effect change in baseball. In 42, late 42, he makes this fairly serious attempt to buy the Philadelphia Phillies and convert them into an all-black team, getting all of the greats from that era, you know, Satchel Paige and Cool Papa Bell. And he, you know, he owns four teams. He owns the Cleveland Indians, which he runs in 48 to the World Championship. And then he has the St. Louis Browns, which are not a great team, but they become, after his ownership, become the Baltimore Orioles. But he keeps that team together for a little while. And then he twice owns the White Sox, and he goes back. He owns them first. The White Sox he owns from 59 to 61, and then he gets very ill and comes back in 75 to 80 and owns them again. And in all of that, he's involved in all sorts of other things and owns a racetrack and has an effect on pro football and has an effect on and very much on the structure of the game. When he first goes to Cleveland, he partners up with people like Bob Hope, and he doesn't have that much money, but he gets, you know, wealthy people to sort of go in with him. And he comes up initially, I'm not giving away the whole book, but one of the cleverest things he came up initially with was with the Cleveland Indians. Was he went to the IRS with a proposition that ball players depreciate just like oil wells, and that he'd be allowed to depreciate the value of a ball player. And all the other owners were incredulous. They couldn't believe he's trying to pull off this stunt, and the IRS goes along with it. So his ability at Cleveland, after he leaves the Indians 4 years after buying it, he gives his investors 20-1 back on a dollar. So he's all over the place. He's, you know, an innovator, showman, finance guy, and very, very funny, and long suffering because he loses a leg through an injury, gets in World War II.
Bob Hope, wasn't he from Cleveland?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He started out, in fact, he was born in England, but he came there, and then he was a boxer at one point, believe it or not.
I can't wait for that book to come out. Paul Dixon has joined us, and you have this book that came out a couple months ago called Baseball Is Defining the National Pastime. And it's a lot of quotations about baseball. You have one from a sports writer in the New York Herald Tribune that kind of reminded me a little bit of our subject. W.O. McGeehan said, quote, "Baseball is a circus. And as is the case in many a circus, the clowns and the sideshows are frequently more interesting than the big stuff in the main tent." What is it about baseball that makes it so compelling? We have these very interesting characters and this amazing language in baseball. What is it about baseball?
I think there are a whole lot of factors that made it. I think, for one thing, it really sort of fits the rhythm of American life. And it's been with us for a long time. I mean, it really parallels the growing season. You know, it starts in the spring when the seeds are going in the ground, and it takes you through the harvest and the fall, and it sort of captures the rhythm of the summer. And, you know, in the 19th century, I think it was carried very much by the newspapers. The telegraphy, you could send a box score as a telegraph message very efficiently from one coast to the other. And so people on one coast the next morning could sort of decipher a whole game that was played on the other coast the night before. You couldn't do that with prose. You couldn't do that with any other way. So you had and then of course the newspaper writers got better and better and better. And sometimes the best writers on the paper were writing about baseball. And then you get into the 20th century, and you get in the 20s, and along comes radio, and radio then becomes tremendously important, and whole networks are founded. For example, the St. Louis Cardinals had a network of stations going down deep into Texas and Oklahoma, and then, you know, north, east, west, and south. And the Red Sox had this universe that extended up to the tip of Maine, and you know, so you had these wonderful announcers filling 2 hours, 2.5 hours of prose, many of whom were sort of born storytellers, and many of them had a southern or a rural cant to what their presentation, which made it all the more appealing and rhythmic. And I think all these things fed. And I think the other thing is the 20th century developed. We got a series of sort of operatic characters. I mean, bigger than life, you know, starting with Babe Ruth and Ty Cobb and going through Dizzy Dean and Satchel Paige and Yogi Berra. And as I flash these names across the radio dial here, you get an image of these guys immediately. Not, you know, Bill Vex, one of them, and Leota Rocher, and out through DiMaggio and then Mantle. But you had these very different personalities. They all seemed bigger than maybe they really were, but we really knew them as characters, and they almost all of them were wonderful. The ones that I mentioned often, you know, gave great quotes and great interviews, and sort of created news on their own. I mean, when Marilyn Monroe marries Joe DiMaggio, that's sort of like every baseball kid's dream. You know?
Paul Dixon joins us. The Dixon Baseball Dictionary, which just came out in paperback, the third edition, is a veritable treasure trove of baseball lore, baseball language, some amazing photos. And it's really interesting to me to see how language keeps changing in baseball and how certain terms that were once in vogue are no longer around, and we keep coining new terms. In fact, one term that used to be much more common back when they played a lot more daytime baseball was the term grandmother, like my grandmother died.
Oh, I see. I didn't get the context. Oh, yeah. That was, you know, the time of the World Series and stuff, and you wanted off from work, and so you'd say, my grandmother died. And, yeah, there was that. And the back then, I mean, back in day radio, you used to have a 12 o'clock hitter who was great in batting practice, but when the game came around at 1 o'clock, he couldn't do anything. Uh-huh. And now that's a 6 o'clock hitter. You know, he's great in BP, but he's no good after that. But, yeah, But the grandmother thing, I mean, I remember as a kid that was just, you know, beyond the, you know, Bob Hope would get on the radio and say, you know, a lot of grandmothers are going to die next week. The World Series is starting. And then your joke was you'd go to your boss and said, I can't work tomorrow. My grandmother died.
There's a lot of language tied to particular franchises, too. I know you're a Baltimore Oriole fan, and we've got the Baltimore Farewell, the Baltimore Chop, the Baltimore Bounce, the Baltimore Dinger, and one of my favorites came out of Baltimore, and it's the Weaver Doctrine. And that's something to do with cleaning home plate, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And it was really, you know, well, you've got it right in front of you. You can...
I don't have it open to that page. I just wrote some notes.
Yeah.
And the Weaver Doctrine was sort of a doctrine about Earl Weaver, the former manager of the Orioles. And it was something about don't go up and start kicking the dirt off the plate while you're arguing with the umpire.
Yeah.
Then we have the monster. And when I think of the monster, I think of the green monster, the wall in Fenway Park. But it actually relates to Bill Veeck, doesn't it? Wasn't that his exploding scoreboard?
Yeah, that's what the other people called it. But that was one of his great innovations with it, was the exploding scoreboard in Chicago. And he took great delight in it. Veeck always wanted to make fireworks a big part of baseball, so that was one that he brought in. You know, sometimes, Vic, I hate to tell you this, but sometimes I balk for a second, a good baseball term, I balk for a second because there are 10,000 words in the book, and sometimes the meat computer isn't as fast as it should be.
But you don't have them memorized?
No.
Okay, well, let's just chat about a few of them. And so many of these I'd never heard of. Like, it was before my time when Huey Jennings, the Tiger manager, used to go, "Eah!" What was that about?
That was just sort of his signature at first base, and he used it to distract other players, and there were various protests. But it was just this call. It was very much a part of the lore of baseball at that time. And he raised one of his feet up, and he raised his arms, and he'd go, "Eon." So that was just one of those bits of baseball folklore that still is with us.
And there's so many pieces of language that relate to hits and pitches. And you've got the Cloud Buster, the Cloud Hunter, the Cloud Scraper, the Cloud Searcher, the Wig Wag, the Wig Wagger, the Bingler, Bingling, Bingles. I love this stuff. It's so colorful. You had, what was it, the Sackalodger?
Sockalodger, yeah. I mean, but you know, and these things keep coming. I mean, I even after this book, I mean, a couple of weeks ago, I got a note from a guy who was talking to a scout, and the scout said, and this is the kind of thing that's constantly happening in baseball, but he said that he had just heard a new term, which was hard 90. And hard 90 was a scout's term for a guy that really put on the, you know, major effort running from the batter's box to first base. Even if he'd hit a grounder, even if he hit a pop fly, he would run that way because there was one chance in 200 or whatever it was that the ball would be dropped or bobbled. And apparently in a scouting report, somebody says he runs the hard 90 means that this guy's really a hustler. And so, you know, you're always reinventing these terms. You know, the whole business of that blooping ball that goes in the outfield, I mean, it's always been called something like a dying quail. And then around the turn of the century, it became a Texas leaguer because one of the teams in the Texas League, the owner claimed his players could drop those balls between those looping sort of balls and drop them in between the outfielders at will. And then that they came up with Texas leaguer. And then, of course, can of corn, which was an allusion to the old grocery store where the grocer would use this long hook and he just sort of pull the can of corn down, or any can, down off the top shelf, and it would tumble down and he'd stretch out his apron and catch it in the apron. And that, you know, that was sort of for this lazy looping fly ball. But the other day I was on a radio show and somebody called up and said, well, when they were growing up, it was called a Dairy Queen because it was sort of a soft serve.
So the opposite of a hard 90, would that be drag a piano?
That would be drag a piano, yes.
And another term for a Texas leaguer might be can't teach that?
Yep.
Because a flare that drops?
Yep, yeah, you can't teach that.
I love that.
Yeah, and you mentioned Baltimore Chop. That was another one of my favorites. That was when the old Baltimore Orioles, the ones that became eventually the New York Highlanders and then the Yankees, those guys, they claimed they could, they kept their dirt packed very tightly in front of the pitcher's mound, and they claimed that they could chop down on the ball and cause it to bounce right over the pitcher's head and, you know, hit that hard bounce. And later on, Casey Stengel had his players rehearse that as the Yankees, and he called it the Butcher Boy Chop. But you sort of needed a hard, you couldn't be doing it with a soggy infield.
The old manicured infield that has cost so many teams. Paul Dixon joins us. We're talking about the Dixon Baseball Dictionary, which just came out in paperback in the third edition, and also his recent collection called Baseball Is, Defining the National Pastime. And when that pitcher, that hurler, that hurlster, that hurlsmith throws a pitch with nothing on it, would you call it a nudist pitch or is a Lady Godiva pitch more?
Or as Tug McGraw would say, a Peggy Lee fastball. Is that all there is?
And then there's all those distractions. Like, I wasn't aware that Dazzy Vance used to use the fluttering cuff so effectively.
Oh, that was, sure. That was a way of getting, sort of confusing the batter. And you still have that stuff. I mean, one of the things that amazes me is the stuff just keeps coming in. I mean, the recent one, I think either way back or way forward, but there's a new term that's everywhere all of a sudden, is pie thrower.
Oh.
And for a pitcher that seems to, rather than truly throw the ball, he sort of pushes it out with his hand. And it's an illusion, not a reality. I mean, he really is still throwing it, but it's just the way he appears out there. And then a lot of this is based on illusion. Like, one of the ones I like in the book is the Bugs Bunny changeup, which was a term that came out after, in the, I guess, about 2002, 2003. And certain writers would start to believe, and some of the ball players, that certain pitchers could throw a pitch that appeared to slow down or almost stop just as it got to the batter's box, thus throwing off the batter's timing. And that became it was used to describe certain pitches, and it alludes back to the famous Bugs Bunny cartoon from the late 40s, in which Bugs strikes out a whole side by throwing one pitch, and it stops, and these monster guys keep getting up and swinging at it, and they can't hit it because it's just outside their reach. And so that stuff's coming all the time, and a lot of it's very colorful.
And if they could actually hit the Bugs Bunny pitch, they might hit a bug on the rug.
That's right. But, you know, one of the things that's interesting about this book, I started working on it in 85 when I was at a ball game in Baltimore with my kids. And they were their young kids then, little boys who are now, you know, grown up men who make, you know, take care of themselves and have grandchildren and all the rest. But one of the things is we're at the game, and they kept saying to me, well, why do they say umpire and baseball and every other sport it's a referee? Or why do they say, why is this a clubhouse, but if they were playing football, it would be a locker room? They were going through all this sort of things that little kids just go through. Or, you know, why is he a shortstop? He's not that short, you know, that kind of thing. And I said I'd go back and look it all up in the library the next day. And I get to the library and there's no such book. And as a writer, you're always looking for you're always looking for that hole in the line where you can run for a touchdown. You're looking, if you're doing reference, especially, you're looking for a perennial. And I saw this, you know, this hole in the line, and I started recruiting people. And I had the first edition out in 89. Then the second in 99, and now this edition. And what's interesting was the number of people I recruited along the way or came to me to help. So I have about over 250 people who have made substantial contributions to the book.
Well, I can't imagine you doing it yourself, even though you have been called a Samuel Johnson, I understand.
Well, or on this one, or even a Webster, but... And that's why I modestly put my name on the title. I mean, the first publisher I had wanted to put the publisher's name on it, and I said nah, because I want to leave it to my kids. Let the kids that gave me the idea, let them, you know, take out over editions after I've left the ballpark.
Well, it's great when those names live on, and your book is filled with names that have lived on, great stars that are no longer playing. But there's still a term in that dictionary that helps us remember them, like Satchel Paige, who had that medium fastball that he called the Little Tom. And when Nolan Ryan was pitching, batters would develop a case of Ryanitis, and they decide they take the day off.
Yes.
And then the great long poetic expressions like spawn insane and 2 days of rain.
Yep.
I love that. That just, it's really America's pastime. And when you read this book, it helps you understand why. When you read stories like the one about Turkey Mike Donlin of the New York Giants and See the Barrels. I love that story. Do you remember that one?
Once again, I've overwhelmed my own writing. But
apparently, he saw a wagon load of empty barrels.
Uh-huh.
Over a century ago, go by the stadium where the Giants played in New York, and he hit because that somehow brought him good luck to see that wagon load of barrels. Well, after that, his coach, I think it was John McGraw, thought, you know, that worked really well, and Turkey Mike hit really well when he saw that wagon load of empty barrels, so I'm going to send a wagon around by the stadium every day loaded with empty barrels, so hopefully he'll see it.
Well, that's a great story, and I'm glad it's in the book. I'm glad I didn't leave it out. But, you know, as you know, my dilemma is the book, I mean, I've got some statistical terms in there, which I had to get, you know, a professional help writing because they're so complicated, and I had to put them in lay language. But I have to rely on my own book to define because they're fairly complicated. But the fact is, the book is 1,000 pages, double columned. So every once in a while, you know, I have to be reminded of a story in the book because the other problem is I'm always picking up new stuff. I mean, the other night in that Mets game was the first walk-off balk, and all of a sudden that's now a term. And that walk-off thing, which sounds like it goes way back, is really a term that was coined by Dennis Eckersley. And I think he first said, we had a great luck. We had a walk-off piece last night, meaning that they won the game with a walk-off single that brought in a run.
Eck speak,
they call that.
Eck speak. I love that guy. Talk about having two different careers. He was a great starting pitcher. I think he threw a no-hitter, didn't he?
Yep.
And then Tony La Russa turned into this amazing closer.
And then these guys live on as just as funny guys. I mean, probably the best interview I ever did with a ballplayer for this book, because he had a great sense of language, was the late Tim McGraw. And Tug McGraw. Tim McGraw is his son, the country singer, but Tug McGraw. And I asked Tug, I said, where'd you get the nickname? He said, well, my mother gave it to me while I was nursing.
Okay.
But he came up with these wonderful things like the Linda Ronstadt fastball, which was a fastball that blew by you.
Uh-huh.
But that's the way we remember these guys. It was sometime about the rhythm they had and the creativity that they had as just guys there. I remember one time I was down in spring training, I was collecting words. You know, other people collect baseball cards. I was collecting words that I'm walking along, and I'm with Oil Can Boyd. I walk up to him, and I say, Mr. Boyd, because you don't call it adult oil can. And I said, Mr. Boyd, I'm doing a book on baseball language. I'd just love to talk to you about it. He sits down on the curb. He's got the white, you know, he's coming out of, going into the clubhouse at spring training, and he starts talking to me. He's just sitting on the curb, and he says, you know, and he's the one who told me that, And I verified it very clearly that some of the terms that we hear came out of the old Negro leagues, and one was long tater or tater for a home run.
Mm.
And he, because Aucan was sort of a bridge between, he knew some of those old guys pretty well, and he was sort of maybe the last bridge between the old time and that actually played actively. But you know, you see it in these, it always sort of refreshes itself.
I remember Oil Can. Wasn't his name actually Dennis?
Yeah.
He was no Sacamayoc, was he?
No. He was...
That's another expression. You'll have to get the Dixon Baseball Dictionary to figure that one out. But it does come from the Negro Leagues.
Yeah. As the downtown, which was an allusion to a ballpark, couple ballparks, but one in Sacramento in particular, where you would hit the ball and you'd see downtown from the batter's box. And so you try to hit it downtown.
Well, so many of these expressions have this wonderful cadence. You've got expressions like chuck and duck, which describes a pitcher or a team that yields a lot of home runs. I love that. You don't hear sportscasters use this stuff that much anymore, do you? I mean, really? Haven't we lost a lot of those great radio guys?
Yeah, I mean, there's still awfully good ones. And I remember a couple of years ago, maybe it was 8 or 9 years ago, when AM radio still had an awful lot of baseball. I remember driving in upstate New York right along the Great Lakes and realized that the Great Lakes were nothing more than a magnificent antenna for picking up late-night baseball games. And, you know, just driving and listening to the different voices. And, I mean, you know, Vin Scully is still very much with us. But you know, there was a time when you would listen to Arch McDonald and Mel Allen and Red Barber. And those guys were really pretty fantastic. And I think there are some today. I mean, I still, you know, there are people, everybody's got their favorite. John Miller is one of my favorites.
He's great.
He's still good.
I heard him use the expression worm burner recently.
Well, that's an oldie. That's the other thing. Every time you think a term is out, it is outmoded, archaic, and arcane, there's somewhere you read in the paper, somebody says, well, any announcer who uses a term like can of corn is from the last century. And then you turn on a radio or listen to Jim Palmer describe a game, and he says, that's a can of corn. So some of these things come back.
Well, Paul, I've got to give it to you. When it comes to writing about baseball, you really murder the smart stuff.
Thank you. I hit the fastball. Yep.
And I can't wait for the Bill Veeck book. That'll be out around opening day next baseball season?
Absolutely, yep.
Well, we really appreciate your time, Paul, and we'll look forward to having you back for that one.
Thanks, Vic.
Our guest today has been Paul Dixon, and his book, The Dixon Baseball Dictionary, the third edition, just came out in paperback. And he also recently published a book he edited called Baseball Is, Defining the National Pastime. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks for tuning in. Tune in next week when my guest will be Harry Dolan. His new noir novel is Very Bad Men. He wrote a book a few years ago called Bad Things Happen that really got the attention of thriller writers. And I'm going to bring you a little excerpt from the book just to give you a little flavor of it. Quote, they came to the end of a block and Bell crossed, tennis shoes scuffling over the surface of the street. Lark picked up his pace and began to close the distance between them. Cars passed heading east into downtown. Leaves rustled in the night wind. When only 10 feet remained between them, the whistling cut off suddenly, and Bell turned, walking backward for a few steps. He stopped beneath a maple tree. I don't know what you need, my friend. His voice was pleasant. It drew Lark up short. What do you think I need? He asked warily. Smack, coke, whatever it is, I don't have it. Bell showed his empty hands. I'm not holding, and I don't have any money either. So there's nothing I can do for you. Lark narrowed his eyes. I don't want your money. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.